I'm Mark Dvorak, and I'm hitting left with the Klonsky Brothers on Lumpin' Radio.
Very nice. I'm just saying very nice first.
Well, first let me just say welcome to the 110th edition of Hitting Left. I'm Mike Klonsky here with my brother Fred this morning on WLPN 105.5 FM, streaming live on lumpinradio.com at Co-Prosperity Sphere in the always sunny Bridgeport neighborhood of Chicago. Fred, do you want to say anything about
that? No? I already said that was really good. Okay. That was worth giving up Steve Earle as our opening music.
Yeah, and our producer this morning is Annie Klein. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning, guys.
I heard you're moving.
I am moving.
Okay, so any volunteers out there who want to help Annie carry down boxes of books and stuff down to the van?
Yeah, tweet at me or something.
Contact her, and I'm sure she'll have pizza. No? No pizza for people.
Don't make offers for other people.
Okay. I would help, but my knee.
Don't bargain other people's contracts.
I would help Annie, but my knee. I just had my knee surgery, and I can't do that. But I'll give you, I can supervise if you want. Okay. As you can probably tell from our Steve Earle-less introduction this morning, that we have a special show in store for you. Pete Seeger's 100th birthday.
Mark, May 3rd.
May 3rd, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and we are celebrating Pete's birthday with a special guest today, Mark Dvorak, who is Chicago's, from what I understand, you're Chicago's official troubadour.
Yeah, somebody said that, on a radio program, and I guess I wanted to believe it.
And how much money does that pay?
Big money.
Being the official troubadour.
Well, you know, what's really interesting about that title was two of my mentors were called that. The first was Win Strachey, who helped start the Old Town School. Yeah. And I got to meet Win late in his life, and we became friends. And of course, he was very prominent in Chicago music in the 50s and through the 60s. And then later on, a guy used to go down to this little club on Lincoln Avenue and listen to all the time, Fred Holstein.
Yeah.
I learned a lot of songs from, and I used to study the way not only he sang great songs, but how he interacted with the audience. And he was a student of Pete Seeger's too, you know. And so those guys.
And he had his own club here.
He had his own club with his brother Ed and Alan. And it was a great hangout for a young guy, and they didn't care how old you were. If you had money, you could get in, you know. And I got to see so many great performers, John Hartford and Dave Van Ronk. Utah Phillips came regularly.
You mentioned Dave Van Ronk, and it brings back to me. I think we may have seen the last time Dave Van Ronk mm-hmm. played in Chicago. At the Armitage location of the mm-hmm. Old Town School, they had a little performance space.
I was there.
So we probably passed each other and it was really a memorable show.
Yeah, he's a memorable artist.
A memorable artist.
So tell us a little. Give us a little background about yourself, Mark. How did you get into this folk music thing?
Well,
Pete Seeger.
And Pete Seeger. Well, that's interesting because when I was growing up. Acoustic music and folk songs were on the radio. Peter, Paul, and Mary were still around, and John Denver. I loved, Far Out and all of that. And then one of my brothers brought home a Led Zeppelin record, and that changed everything utterly. So music was around our house. And as we grew older and got into, our favorite artists and going to concerts and all that, I read this book
Uh-oh.
About Bob Dylan.
Uh-oh.
You know, I wanted to be Bob Dylan.
That's dangerous. Didn't we all? Yeah.
And then I read the book. I didn't want to be him anymore. but in his book, it's a great book. Anthony Scaduto was the first biography of Bob Dylan around 72. It was published. And he talked about in the village when he was making the rounds in the village as a young guy, and he talked about Pete Seeger, and he called Pete Seeger a saint. And I'd heard of Pete Seeger, you know, and I didn't realize I'd heard his music as well. But I went and got a Pete Seeger record. And then a friend of mine loaned me a banjo, and in the case of the banjo was this a little manuscript book, How to Play the Five-String Banjo by Pete Seeger. And so I looked at that for a long time. I couldn't figure out how to do it. But I kept coming back to Pete Seeger. And as I was getting into music and, you know, messing around in garage bands, and the songs I really love, you know, to play, and they made me feel things, and my friends, we'd go to the concert, and I kept coming back to Pete's music was different. It was different. It was grounded in something other than, what my friends were all into, and I kept coming back to that. Well,
like what in particular?
Well, at the end of the day, we were really into Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, and I still follow Neil Young around. He's going to teach me how to get old.
We can tell you something about that.
Yeah.
After the show.
All right. And at the end of the day, Pete's music came. He's always teaching you something. And as I came back to Seeger's music, I learned about Lead Belly. I learned about Woody Guthrie. And it made me interested in the music from the generation before. And now I look back. I have more to look back on now than maybe I have to look forward to. But I can see how those songs taught me how to live.
How much were you, when you first got into it, were you aware of Pete's earlier history of radical politics?
Not immediately, you know, not immediately. And I got to meet Pete on a handful of occasions, and we had lunch, and we talked on the phone a couple of times, and it's pretty well known fact that he was a member of the Communist Party, and he got in a lot of trouble.
It's back in the '40s.
Yep, and so we had lunch, and he a wonderful guy to sit and talk to,
yep.
And he made it his business too to find out what younger people were working on and what they were thinking, and he was very, very available and very accessible. And I asked him, I said, so you were a member of the Communist Party? And he goes, I don't remember. You know, been there and done that. But of course, when he got called before the House on Un-American Activities around 55, all the other artists and people that were called in pled Fifth Amendment.
Right.
Right. So I'm not going to say anything. I don't want to incriminate myself, which worked actually as, okay, well, that means you're protecting something, and they all lost their employment. And Pete called a lawyer friend. He said, I want to plead First Amendment. And he stood in that hearing, and he said, you have no right to ask any American these questions. I sing for everybody. And he brought his banjo. I have a picture of him carrying his banjo into the hearing. And he asked the guy interviewing, he said, look, I have my banjo right there. I'd love to sing you one of our newest songs. It's about America, a country I love very deeply. And he goes, Mr. Seeger, there will be no banjo playing. But he brought it, well, you know, that's walking the walk.
You know, I'm an absolute believer in that a little more banjo music in the halls of Congress would make for a great change in the right direction, don't you think?
I'm about it, because when you get into the arts, whether it's dancing or painting, music, writing, you have to come to terms with yourself, and you have to decide what right and wrong is, and you have to learn to be honest with yourself. Art teaches you that. Art teaches you to open. Art teaches you to consider the other. And of course, politics is not art. Politics is politics, but it's so unbalanced now. I mean, I just read the paper today, and the CEO of Sears, they found out he's siphoning $2 billion away from the company. Who are these people? You know, who are these people? And you know, in the news of the investigation that Mueller was delivered yesterday, or the Attorney General delivered it, and you hear one side talk about the document, you hear the other side talk about the document. They're talking about two different documents.
It's like they live in two different worlds.
Yeah, they do, you know. And I, you know, when Strachey told me a neat story in 1968, when the Old Town School was just 10 years old, and they were right on North Avenue, still in Old Town, and this was 2 weeks after the 68 Democratic Convention, right, where the rocks and the riots and all of that. And
yeah, I was there.
You were there. Yeah. And I remember my dad took us on a car ride to go back by to see where that happened a few days, the weekend after. But anyways, it's the first week of class at Old Town School, and people are gathering, having coffee, jamming in the room and before class began. And then Wynn noticed this young man with long hair and a flannel shirt, he's picking bluegrass guitar, and another guy sits down with him, a guy he knew was a Chicago police officer. And there they were, sitting there, picking out the 9-pound hammer. He said 2 weeks ago they'd been hitting each other over the head with sticks and rocks. He goes, that's the power of this kind of music.
You want to play us a little something to get us going here?
Yeah, I do. This is a hopeful song. It'll be better when it's better. Oop, I got a problem here. Oh, the sky's falling down and the creek is coming up that old rickety bridge. Lord, is running out of luck. Nothing left to do but let the river overflow. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. Yeah, the times are getting harder and the money's getting tight and the cost of living's killing me. Nothing's going right. Now the polar cap is melting and the desert's gonna blow. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. When I was a little kid, I did what I was told. Now I go to work each morning in a corporate blindfold. I'm feeling like it's getting late. The gate is gonna close. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. I dug myself a hole and I fell right in. And a man comes along asking me where I've been. He said he never really cared. He just lets the four winds blow. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. I sat down and wrote a letter to the president. I asked him where the hell he thought the Constitution when he tweeted me this afternoon. He said he didn't know. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. Picking at the scab is never gonna make it heal, and every broken bone will teach you how it's really gonna feel. Now the sun is gonna rise again, the rooster's gonna crow. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. Yeah, the sky is falling down and the creek is coming up that old rickety bridge. Lord, is running out of luck. Nothing left to do but let the river overflow. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose. It'll be better. It'll be better. It'll be better when it's better, I suppose.
Wow, fantastic. Is that an original?
Yeah, yeah.
You wrote that?
I wrote that a couple of presidents ago.
And, is that how you mark time?
Yeah, well, that's one way. And it's a song gets a lot of play and a lot of response, and you got to remain hopeful.
Now, you didn't come alone here today, Mark.
Oh, no.
Who's your friend over here?
Well, I was lucky enough to meet Stephanie probably more than 20 years ago. She was a student of mine at the Old Town School of Folk
Stephanie
Music.
Schott?
Schrott.
Okay.
And her life moved on, and she married and has a beautiful sons that are now man cubs.
They are my man cubs.
Yeah, and yep. You moved away back to Michigan, to Grand Rapids.
We did, and then moved back to Chicago,
and I got a Facebook message one day. Maybe you don't remember me, but I'm Stephanie, and we're working on this project, and would you like to come play music for our clients at the Oak Park River Forest Food Pantry?
So Stephanie, we're talking about music and potluck.
Potlucks.
What is that?
That is a community organization that I co-founded with some friends, Betsy Backus and Liz Zeal, and we're about gathering people together and around good music and good food, but we also always raise money to help neighbors experiencing homelessness or hunger. Wow. And we also support a music fund at the Oak Park River Forest Community Foundation called Songs for Peace and Justice.
And how do people find you on the, can they find you on the web?
Or? They can. We have a website, musicandpotlucks.org is our website. And we have about 4 to 6 events a year, potlucks or house concerts or public concerts around the Oak Park River Forest area or Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And when's the next one?
Is there
an event coming up?
We do. We have an event on May 10th at Dominican University in River Forest.
All right. I'm going to make it over there for that thing.
We hope so, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I used to teach at Dominican.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I taught sociology over there for
we'll be celebrating Pete's 100th birthday that day.
I worked cheap.
Yeah. yeah.
All right. Well, Stephanie, thank you for coming in here this morning.
Thanks for having us.
I want to get back to Mark. Let's talk a little.
That was good. I'm back in my chair. I felt because I just said I'm feeling like this is like it's 30 years ago, and it's 10:30 at night on a Saturday, and I've got. The midnight special on WTTW.
Okay. So, yeah. Fred, you and I were doing a lot of talking about Pete Seeger this morning.
We were
over coffee.
Well, one thing that reminded me is that we grew up in L.A. and our version of Holstein's or the places in Old Town was a club called the Ash Grove. There were two clubs, right?
Yeah.
There was a Troubadour. That was where the Birds played,
right,
and
famous Troubadour,
Johnny Rivers,
but there was this mad fight, right? Ideological battle between the purists and then the kind of popular stuff. And the Ash Grove was the home of the purists, where like you.
Yep.
There it was Ed Pearl, and I think he had a brother too ran the place.
Yeah.
And as high school kids, you could sit around the front room and Taj Mahal would drop by. Or people like that, and they'd be fiddling with their guitars and teaching you not me so much because I could never learn an instrument, but all my friends could, and it was like and they would learn
a big hootenanny going on.
Yeah, stuff. Yeah.
And Pete was certainly, and I was thinking. Pete taught at the Old Town School, did he not?
No, he didn't teach there, but he was very close friends with Wynn Strachey, and Pete often talked about there needs to be a music school where people like us could go to learn how to sing and play together. Because in the 1950s, if you went for music lessons, you were taught proper notation, classical discipline, and so Wynn thought it was a good idea. Who was actually classically trained in beautiful bass, baritone, vocal voice, but he met a guy named Frank Hamilton who was from Los Angeles, and he accompanied Wynn at an old club called the Gate of Horn, and Frank at age 20 was already adept at teaching skills. Different levels at the same time, and when Wynn saw this, he goes, "We can start our school."
Yeah.
And Pete always when he was in Chicago, he always stopped by the Old Town School.
I guess when I had heard from people that when I say he taught there, mm-hmm. I guess it was kind of like a drop-in teacher.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of teacher he was. Yeah. And what's remarkable, Frank Hamilton and I became friends in the 1990s, and he was very close to Pete. He was a Pete protege, and he, you know, he said, "Oh, you should call him up. You should call him up and talk to him." And we talked on the phone, and I said, "What would I say to him?" You know, I read all his books, I listened to all his writing, and that's when I realized everything he does, he's teaching. He teaches you. He realized.
Well, there was never a concert in which that wasn't participatory, right?
That's
You didn't go to watch and listen.
That's right. And you join in, and you're going to learn something about history. You're going to learn something about what's happening in the news. You're going to get. And he was, you know, and the thing about Pete, highly politically charged, but he was. He was a crack entertainer. I mean, he knew the shtick. He was funny.
That's right.
He knew the timing of how to pace a program and very engaging.
What my brother and I were talking about over coffee this morning was that a lot of times, as happens, people try to take people like Pete, who was certainly when he was in his 90s was a radical free thinker, and then they try to turn them into like puppy dogs and
harmless icons.
Yeah, exactly. Good term.
Well,
but one of the things that I remember as a Pete Seeger fan growing up was that it wasn't that this idea that he was like mainly involved in Americana in this kind of. But really, he was a globalist, at least when it came to culture.
Ooh, internationalist.
Internationalist. But he thought globally.
He thought globally. And he sure did.
Just that word has been tainted.
Yeah,
so
I know.
Much
but I think we should reclaim it.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
And that he was a cultural globalist.
Yes, he was.
And so that was it. Was he who introduced us to, say, Wimoway or Guantanamera?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
He kind of introduced us to the music of the world, not just our own.
He sure did. And when after World War II was when Israel became a country and United Nations was established, and he wanted to start a singing group that reflected the world culture. He wanted six people in it. He wanted mixed race. He wanted Asian. He wanted men and women. It's never been done before, and at the end of the day, they settled on a quartet, and they called themselves the Weavers, and they taught America its own folk music and introduced world songs from around the world to a popular audience.
I was watching an old YouTube video of Pete's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and after a rather long speech by Harry Belafonte, who I love. There was a shorter, but he went on, and then there was a shorter talk by Arlo Guthrie, who reminded us that he said that when Goodnight Irene made it in the top 10 on the Billboard charts by the Weavers, which Pete was a part of at the time, like you said, he said it was probably the most embarrassing moment of Pete's life was to have a song that he had done hit the top 10 on the Billboard charts.
Yeah, and those first records were released by Decca, and they've got horns and choruses, and they're corny as hell. But I love them. But it was Gordon Jenkins who produced it, and he supported the Weavers, and he supported their political background. And he said, if we put horns and choruses, it'll get through, right? If you just sit there with your banjo, it'll never sell. And so they got Wimoway and what's that IWW song? The Banks Are Made of Marble.
Oh yeah.
This Land Is Your Land. You know. So
we grew up with all that. That was that was the music of our childhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what being a red diaper baby.
That's a red diaper baby.
Yeah. Our house was surrounded. I mean, was inundated with that, with those songs.
Yeah. And you know, I think.
And then also, you know, our time in the civil rights movement.
How about that?
That was
right?
The music of the civil rights movement,
right,
in many ways. You know,
that's right.
Yeah, and So you were talking about the Weavers.
Yeah.
And so the Weavers, they also got in trouble in the McCarthy period too.
Yeah, they did.
And but I remember them. Actually, I remember them from going to summer camps.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, lefty summer camps, and the Weavers, and Earl Robinson, and Pete Robeson, and all these people would show up and perform. Yeah. You know, and to me, they were just like regular people. You know, like,
they were regular people, and the thing is their art was cutting edge at that time. You know, their sensibilities and their aesthetic was universal and powerful.
Yeah. Now you you took a trip. As I recall, trying to go out into America and try to find the origins or the music of people like Woody Guthrie and Yep. Lead Belly and Yep. Pete. Tell us about that a little bit. And
well,
we don't have a few minutes before break, I think. So,
I became interested in. You know, here's the thing: I was listening to a lot of music and. Then, and I said earlier, I stumbled into the Old Town School, and I stumbled into Holstein's, and I'm watching people like Utah Phillips work, and Fred, and our theme, and then when Pete came to town, we'd go see him, and it was like these people knew something, and they were accessible, and I wanted to play the guitar, and I wanted to be able to sit there and come from a place of authenticity in my own experience. And these songs were so confounding that, you know, they all have something inside them that you have to find a way to crack open and get to it. And when you get there, you realize that song's about your own life. It's about a life that you might have in common with somebody else. And so that will lead you places, and it will lead you to people.
And it led you on this trip, which was chronicled in 1993 documentary called Lead Belly's Legacy.
Right, right.
And
I went down and I had his first car I ever owned that I didn't buy with 100,000 miles on it, and it was a pretty.
So it made it. It made. It
I knew I could. I knew I could get down to Louisiana and back, and I found Lead Belly's grave behind the Shiloh Baptist Church in Mooringsport, and took a rubbing of the gravestone and so forth, and then it was only a couple of years after I met Lead Belly's niece, Tiny Robinson, and her husband Jim in their home, and she turned me on to all things Lead Belly. And
we got a break. Why don't you take us out?
Take us out. Mm-hmm.
Brendan, we'll be back in a couple minutes.
I heard Woody Guthrie sing a song for everyone. This land was made for you and me. He sang about a better world that was gonna come, and pastures of plenty always free. But a picture from life's other side is all I ever see. Hard traveling is how it's gonna be. The gambling man's still rich, and the working folks are poor. And this train ain't bound for glory anymore. This train ain't bound for glory anymore. The do-re-mi don't trickle down like they said it would. Wall Street keeps on getting more and more. With so many little homes for sale in our neighborhood, this train ain't bound for glory anymore. This train ain't bound for glory anymore. We've been sticking to the Union, we've been sticking to our guns, but mister, we've been busted one by one. No bugle call for peace, just another dirty little war. And this train ain't bound for glory anymore. This train ain't bound for glory anymore. I packed my bags to look for work somewhere down the road. kissed my wife at the railway station door. Then I heard the blind conductor call, "Everybody, get on board. This train ain't bound for glory anymore. This train ain't bound for glory anymore. And this land was made for you and me."
And we'll be right back.
If you enjoy listening to Hitting Left and other programs like this on Lumpin' Radio, consider becoming a member today. More information is at lumpinradio.com.
Oh, what will you give me? Say the sad bells of Rimini. Is there hope for the future? Say the brown bells of Methel. Who made the mine owners? Say the black bells of Rumba. And who robbed the miner? Say the grim bells of Blina. They will plunder willy-nilly. Say the bells of Caerphilly. They have fangs, they have teeth. Shout the loud bells of Neath. Even God is uneasy. Say the moist bells of Swansea. And what will you give me? Say the sad bells of Remney. Throw the vandals in court. Say the bells of Newport. All would be well if. Say the green bells of Cardiff. Why so worried, sisters, why? Sang the silver bells of Wye. Oh, what will you give me? Say the sad bells of Rimini. Give me, say the sad bells of Rimini. Is there hope for the future? Say the brown bells of Methel. Who made the mine owner? Say the black bells of Rhonda. The miner, say the grim bells of Blina.
Throw the vandals in court.
This is WLPN LP Chicago, 105.5 FM Lumpin' Radio. We're hitting left with the Klonsky Brothers with Mark Dvorak today, celebrating the 100th birthday of Pete Seeger. Happy birthday, Pete.
Happy birthday.
We were talking in the break, and we promised to talk about it again, the family story and our side of the family about my wife, Ann, who was at the Newport Folk Festival in which Bob Dylan went electric. She was on the side, as my kids constantly remind her, was on the side of the crowd that booed Bob Dylan. But there's a story that Pete also was upset with Bob going electric, yeah. And took an axe to the to the cord to the speaker.
Yeah,
and you're saying that maybe this was misinterpreted.
Well, how do I know?
You know,
and Pete, as you said, always denied doing that, and of course. He and Bob were quite close, you know, at Newport when Bob was doing his folky thing, and Pete was a mentor to him, and then Bob came out with the Butterfield Blues Band, and they just blew the place apart. And then at that time, Pete was doing this bit in his show where he was demonstrating a work song. So he's traveling with an axe. Right, and so before the concert, he'd go out and find a log, and then he'd walk backstage, and he said, "Here, let me show you a real work song." And he'd get this log and clump it down on the stage floor, and he'd get this axe, and he'd start chopping the wood. And he's a very famous wood chopper. He heated his home for decades
which he built himself
with a lot of other people. And so he's singing this work song to the rhythm of swinging an axe. And I always thought he probably had that axe because he was going to do that bit during his segment at the Newport Folk Festival. And he could have, you know, was he carrying it to cut the cables?
I think he had the axe, and then he threatened the sound people.
Well, he claimed that really he was just concerned that the sound system wasn't of good quality and that people weren't hearing
hear the lyrics of Maggie's Farm.
Hear the lyrics of Maggie's Farm, which was probably Bob's intention.
Well, you know, love Bob. And so, you know, who knows?
But the thing is, I think that Pete, from what I have been able to discern, he was kind of a Luddite in a way. He was kind of an anti-technology guy.
Maybe that's right.
Yeah. I think he said one time that if he would have been around when the people invented the wheel, he would have warned them. You stop now. You don't know what you're getting us into.
This can only end badly.
I don't know.
Yeah. And anyway, I think he became very distrustful of technology and the music. You know, he was, like we've said, he was kind of a purist.
Well, he was a purist, but
he paid a lot of attention to the lyrics.
Yeah.
And when Dylan went electric, I mean, it changed everything, you know?
It did change everything. But, you know, what's interesting, too, is when the Weavers started having hit records with folk music, that changed everything.
Well, I think he was kind of disappointed in a way, wasn't he? I think the Weavers did a commercial one time, maybe a cigarette commercial.
Yeah, they did.
And I think Pete quit.
He quit.
He quit the band.
It wasn't because his band on – because he – had anything against smoking. His wife smoked for years, but the tobacco workers in North Carolina were on strike, and he said, we shouldn't do this commercial because we need to support those working strikers. And that's the genesis for the song We Shall Overcome came from, that movement, that strike. And so they took a vote, and he said, if you vote to do the commercial, I'll do the commercial with you. And they took a vote, and Pete was the only guy against it, and he did the commercial and he left the band. I think there were a lot of other.
And of course, Pete's role in popularizing "We Shall Overcome" has almost become is like mythological, right?
It is mythological, and
of course, it started with Guy Carawan was the one who actually introduced it.
He wrote it, right? Yeah. Yeah.
The guy, there's on my website, Frank Hamilton, my friend, tells the entire story from his perspective of how We Shall Overcome came about. Frank taught it to Guy. And Pete was singing the song as early as the 40s, but it had a kind of a rhythm of... he called it very, very... We shall overcome. We shall overcome. And so Frank heard, he used to in Los Angeles go to the black churches just to listen with the music, and he heard this rhythm. It's like what they call a 12/8 feel, and it rocks, right? So he taught that song with that feel to Guy, who moved to North Carolina with his wife. He taught that new version to the people there. And then that song spread like wildfire. The black people embraced that version. And when Pete came down in the 60s for civil rights, he heard at the Highlander Center.
At Highlander School.
Right. And that was the gathering place. He heard people singing this song. And he goes, holy cow. And even on one of his
That's where Carowan was at the Highlander Center.
Yeah. He was at the Highlander Center. And even in a very famous records of Pete is his live concert from 1963 at Carnegie Hall. And he ends with We Shall Overcome. And it's so powerful. The whole crowd is singing in harmony. And he's teaching harmonies on the spot. And he goes, and here's the verse they wrote down in Montgomery, Alabama. And Frank wrote that verse. And I think it was always a sticking point between Frank and Pete. And when he told me that story, he said, be careful who you tell that to. And then after Pete passed away, Frank and I were in Lexington, Kentucky for a kind of a memorial concert. And we met, and I said, Frank, you need to tell that story now. It's okay, you know, and he did. And so I wanted to tell that story too. And many, many hands shaped that song, and many voices shaped that song.
And I think Pete kind of opened the door for a lot of other
absolutely
singers
absolutely
during the civil rights movement.
You know, like. Absolutely, he gave voice and credibility to that movement.
The Freedom Singers,
yeah, absolutely. And they all came to Newport, and so forth. And he's a remarkable artist. And
Bernice Reagan.
That's right.
And others, yeah.
Yep.
Pete, one thing I noticed, you picked up the banjo a little while ago. Pete, aside from being a singer and a musician, he was really into redefining the banjo as an instrument,
wasn't he? He sure was.
Yeah. I think he designed a banjo, a longer neck banjo, mm-hmm, with more. Chords on it.
Yeah, he made my understanding is his father was a musicologist, Charles Seeger, and he took Pete, who was then a teenager, to the Asheville, North Carolina Folk Festival, and there he saw these long neck banjos there, and down in North Carolina there were musicians who used the banjo to accompany their singing, and not just square dance picking, you know. And so when Pete chose the banjo as his main instrument, it's kind of limited in if you want to sing in the key of F or E. And so he bought two banjos and sawed the neck off and fused them together. And then later he carved his own long neck out of this hunk of ebony that he found in South America or somewhere. And it's a clunker. I've seen that banjo, and it's just amazing. and then later the Vega Banjo Company made him a Pete Seeger custom model.
Can I get you to put it to play something on
the banjo?
Yeah, I was telling you that when I was teaching back in the day for 30 years across the hall from the music teacher who Cynthia Saputis, who would kill me if I didn't have you ask you to play.
We don't want to lose you.
No. And, you know, you don't want to get music teachers mad at you.
No, they're insufferable. All right. Well, this is my favorite banjo song. I'll play a little bit of it. I learned this on January 20th, 1989, in Columbia, Missouri, at a little place called the Shea Coffee House, right on the campus of UM. And I remember that because it was Lead Belly's 100th birthday. And I went down there with my 12-string guitar and did my best imitation of a Southern blues singer, which totally tanked. And I heard a guy play this song about a real man he grew up with. Reuben, you can play your banjo. Reuben, you can play your banjo all night long. We've been waiting all your life just to hear you play your song. Reuben, you can play your banjo all night long. We'll be sitting around the fire just in case we can play along. When I was just 16, I had a little dream about playing on my daddy's banjo. And when I picked it up and it made a sound, I found I couldn't let the darn thing go. You know it felt so good, I knew that I could play to let the music flow. Oh, I would hit those strings just to hear them ring when I played my old banjo. Hey Reuben, you can play your banjo all night long. We've been waiting all your life just to hear you play your song.
For you, Cynthia.
Yeah, that was written by a guy named Bartholomew Bean in from Kirksville, Missouri.
Now, are you playing around town?
As long as I'm able. Yes.
Where can we hear you outside of Hitting Left?
Outside of Hitting Left, well, I'm always hanging out at the Old Town School. And
are you teaching over there?
I still teach one class on Tuesday nights. And then I lead the jam session and sing-along on Thursdays. You should all come by and sing with us. And
can I bring my ukulele?
Absolutely. There's a whole contingent of ukulele players.
That's where I learned.
Mm-hmm. And I'll be performing at Dominican University and with my group of student singers. They're called the Power of Song Singers, and we work on singing harmony together. And then I'm going to East Lansing, Michigan, and I'm going to be in Evanston May 3rd. And check my website because it's all there. I can't remember anything.
What's the website?
www.markdvorak.com.
Okay.
And my schedule's right on the homepage.
That's pretty easy to remember.
Well, it is for me, but I hope you'll come by and leave a note. And there's all kinds of things to read and look at and... And there's the story of We Shall Overcome is on there, and I'm also you can get a hold of me through musicandpotlucks.org, where we've been collecting Pete Seeger stories, and we intend to keep that going for perpetuity because Pete touched so many lives, and people have so many. One of the great stories is this couple. Ann and Bill from Oak Park, she writes how they love folk music and are of that age. And then we broke up and got back together, and I went over to the Bill's apartment where he lived with his parents, and his parents were gone, and we put on a Pete Seeger record, and we sat on the couch together, and somewhere between We Shall Overcome and Guantanamera, he proposed, and I accepted, and Guantanamera is our song. You know, it's a lovely memory of how music flows into our lives and becomes the soundtrack for the thresholds that we pass through.
You're a teacher as well as an artist and a musician. What's your thoughts about music and teaching?
Mm.
Do you have a certain philosophy?
Yeah,
tell us about it.
Well, someone asked me what's your teaching method. I go, I don't have one. Basically, and I read lots of books by a great teacher named W. A. Matthew out in California, and he said, "Your first job in teaching music is to help people." And from someone else, I heard this saying: "Go, you have to decide whether you're going to teach music or teach people." And the recommendation was start with people.
I always, whenever I meet a colleague, I always. Some people will ask, "Well, what do you teach?" And but I always ask them, "Who do you teach?"
Yeah, you know, and to differentiate, if you're if you're training for an orchestra pit or you're training for auditioning for a band, that's a whole different way of learning. I work at a community school, so the value in the education is more on a social plane than a professional plane. But that's where the music I love lives, you know. And I've been in nightclubs and recording studios, and you get guys telling you, you know, it's just a whole different environment. And
we've only got a few minutes left, Mark. How about playing us one last tune before?
Will you sing it with me?
Well, it wouldn't be a Pete Seeger thing if we didn't all sing along.
Right? Well, let's try.
Wait, I mean, hold on a second. Okay, I'm ready.
Are you ready now? That was rehearsal. This is the first.
I'm not going to get too close.
This was the first song I ever fell in love with, and the first song I ever played in public. Come on, Annie.
Come on, Annie. You
got Where have all the flowers gone?
Stephanie, come on.
Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? Young girls pick them, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Where have all the young girls gone? Where have all the young girls gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young girls gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young girls gone? Taken husbands, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? And where have all the young men gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young men gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young men gone? They're all in uniform. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Where have all the soldiers gone? Long time passing. Sing it out. Where have all the soldiers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the soldiers gone? Gone to graveyards, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they Where have all the graveyards gone? They've gone to flowers, everyone. When will we ever learn? Where have all the graveyards gone? Long time passing. Where have all the graveyards gone? Long time ago. Where have all the graveyards gone? Gone to flowers, everyone. When will we ever learn? When will we ever learn? So long, Pete.
Happy birthday.
And thank you so much, Mark Dvorak. Stephanie Schrott.
Schrott.
Schrott. I'll get it right one of these times.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks a lot for everything you do, for music and potluck, for being Chicago's troubadour, and thank you for helping us remember Pete on this great day.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I'm a new, you have a new fan of Lumpin' Radio and Hitting Left.
You have a couple of new fans yourself.
All right, I'm glad to know you both, and Annie, thank you for making it so easy.
And, you know, I think... we're going to go out with a Pete Seeger song.
Love it.
You know, one thing we didn't get to talk about was the Spanish Civil War.
Uh-huh.
And Pete was a big supporter of the Spanish Civil War.
Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Lincoln Brigades, which our dad was fought in. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to take out with Pete doing a Spanish Civil War song.
Beautiful.
And ready to go, Annie? All right, tune in next week. Who we got next week?
We're doing a rerun of the show with...
Making History.
Making History.
Eating Blintzes with with Dick Flax and Mickey Flax.
And so, we'll be back live in 2 weeks.
It's a good time.
See you then.